anger, sexual lust, the sorts of things that you experience when you're playing a video game. All these concepts originated with Karl Marx.
Is there anything you've been playing lately? It's hard to imagine you've had a lot of time for that, but if there's anything that's given you solace in the darkness.
Oh yeah. Mario Wonder is great.
I've heard that.
It's the best 2D Mario. It's better than all of the new Super Mario Brothers games, which were all decent. And then some of the Nintendo DS ones were pretty good.
I remember
design is always fun.
I think Odyssey was quite good.
Yes.
I remember that
Odyssey
one.
Was exceptionally good. Odyssey is just kind of like a roided out version of all of the 3D Mario games in a way that just like the other ones all seem dated.
Yeah.
And they're still great. You know, I liked Galaxy and Galaxy 2. I played all of them. But they automatically seem dated as a result because it's so good. And I think Wonder does kind of the same thing. I'm still I just actually 100%ed and unlocked the final level last night. And I'm having a blast with it, especially if you like to play platformers quickly. The platforming, I mean, the style is great. The music is good. It's very cute. It's very funny in places. But the physics and the platforming mechanics feel really smooth, and it's a very fun sort of kinetic experience. And yeah, I love it. I think it's great. And I'll probably just play it through again once I'm done with this first time.
That rules. I'm not personally I haven't kept up with the franchise, the Mario and Luigi Brothers franchise. I've played Odyssey. I played Sunshine before that, and I'm not going to look up how many years were between those two games. And then obviously, like, you know, Super Mario 64 and a bunch of the 2D ones back in the day. But I've been hearing the hype. A character of ill repute told me that to the best of my knowledge, pornographic invention Bowsette is actually in a Mario game now. I haven't actually checked that, but I've decided it's funny if that's true, and we need to really think about the implications, you know?
I can't say I recall recall that on my playthrough, but you know, it's been in off hours and very late at night in some instances, so I could have missed that salient detail.
I don't think it's in this one.
Not in this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it's in. I might have been lied to, but this is what people on like the streets are telling me. This is where I get most of my Mario information. And it's a lot more fun for me to not check. So I'm going to put that information out there via the podcast, and people can hopefully also run with it without checking. That's really my aspiration for them. With any information they receive.
Yeah, when I'm in Charlestown talking to the Irish mob, the first thing I'm asking them about is the hot Mario tips, and I don't question what they say.
Yeah, no, like, why would they lie to you? You know, it's, at a point, you're just being rude, you know? So,
are you playing anything?
I just finished Blasphemous 2, which we most certainly will have to do an episode on at some point.
I need to play that. I like the first one a lot.
Yeah, just Catholicism Reloaded. I think it does everything the first one does, but mechanically is a little bit... I liked it a bit more. It's... I mean, I, you know, I won't get too into it because I'm sure we'll talk about it properly at some point. But it's fucking good. If you like the first one, you're gonna like the second one. Just like with other hit Dark Souls influenced Metroidvania series, Hollow Knight, where if you like the first one, you will definitely like playing Silksong in 2045. So that'll be exciting for you.
I replayed Hollow Knight recently, actually.
Yo, it's so good.
It's great. It's really, yeah. Speaking of good platforming.
Yeah, it's hard. It gets hard, but it's done so well that it never feels like. I can get kind of frustrating at platforming if it feels kind of unreliable, but Hollow Knight, it always feels like it's my own damn fault when I die, which is good.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3. I don't know if you've heard about this game. Don't know if you've heard about it. It's, as far as I can tell, it's a dating sim, but sometimes you have to kill like a lot of gnolls. And I don't really get why, like, that doesn't seem relevant to the dating sim component. Mm-hmm. But I'm traveling around with the Polycule, which obviously is Karlak, Asterion, and, you know, placeholder here. It's Shadowheart for now, but, you know, we'll see. Options are open. It's hard to blame anyone for not playing it, because you need, like, 100 hours to sink into that shit, and I am very much still in Act 1 because I've been very busy, so it's going to be, I think that's going to be my, like, game I'm playing for months to come.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm going to move on to next. I got it for my husband for his birthday, and he has started playing it. We both played, I played other Baldur's Gate games, and then we also both played the Divinity games and really liked them, and he's loving it so far. From what I can tell,
it's good. It's I think it improves on a lot of things in Divinity, but also in part just because I like the D&D 5e system more than what they had in Divinity.
I'm looking forward to that actually.
Yeah, it's very well implemented, I think, and it's got as has been well documented at this point. It's got really good voice acting, which is important for an RPG, and actually, it's kind of insane how much is in there. I think it's been well discussed that the way they made the game, where they made like the first act almost as like a proof of concept, and then we're in early access for, I don't know, like 2 years, just making the game while getting like money in from purchases, allowed them to do some pretty wild stuff. And I don't know how I feel about that, because I do find that model of development kind of annoying. I understand when like small studios do it, but I was a bit like, you guys surely have, you've been given money, right? For this, but it's hard to argue with, it's hard to argue with what we got. It's pretty sick. And it's like weirdly horny. like people have made a big thing of like, yeah, this, you know, characters fuck, there's, you know, there's romance and like sexuality in the game, but like, the horniness is in the minutia. Just every things that are not sexual in that game are horny like all the time, and I don't know what to make of that. I don't know what's going on, but is that maybe going to be like? I feel like fantasy as a genre is getting more and more like queer over the past decade, and I'm wondering if that's our cultural Marxism influence on it. Is just going to be that it gets horny. Because, like, it's better that than the focus on race science. If those are the two options, I mean, I'm on board, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about what color elves should be. You can just make them all, you know.
I just want to fuck them, you know?
Go to town on each other.
Go to town on them elves. I mean, not elves, of course. Elves are, you know, one of the vilest of the races. That's the important thing, is, you know. I've been thinking a bit about Peter Jackson's adaptation of Lord of the Rings and kind of some of the choices he made. Did you ever read those books by any chance?
Yeah, I read them as a kid, and then I watched the movies.
So I'm also coming from a place of it's been a long time since I've read them, so I'm kind of partly remembering things. But I feel like the orcs were not racialized really in the books. I kind of feel like that one was a lot on Peter Jackson. I don't know if you agree there.
The race stuff in general, a lot of it is on Peter Jackson's choice, because while there is like clearly influence in like his European upbringing and perspective in the development, it's less racially specific than you would think based off of Peter Jackson. Racial specificity, I guess, is the thing that Jackson brought to it, and it was a choice, one could say.
It's an interesting, because I feel like if you're adapting Tolkien's work, you're already, like, there is a lot of race stuff on the page overall, like, mm-hmm. what the elves are and how, you know, you're meant to think of them, and the fact that this idyllic society in the Shire that must be protected, of course, is just, you know, like middle-class English countryside living, really. Mm-hmm. Like, right. There's, you know, he's in a lot of ways, he's writing what he knows, which is fair enough. And, you know, being a Britaloid, there's, you know, there's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. So to add, in fact, to the dubious sort of racial nature of Lord of the Rings, I suppose, is something that I find a really weird choice. I don't really know what to make of it.
Yeah, I don't know. We're, you know, I'm sure there's some lineage of fantasy colorism that's easy to pull from, that I'm not familiar with, as not, you know, the most well-versed in the genre fiction fantasy stuff, but
I mean, there's probably people listening right now who do know much better than us, because I'm not huge mm-hmm. on fantasy either, and a big part of it is because I think of how much it seems to lean on these assumptions of these different, you know, races of people, you know, having these very fundamental characteristics. I think the fantasy I've liked most is the stuff that kind of gets more tongue in cheek with it. Like Warhammer is fun because it takes all the worst instincts of fantasy and cranks them to 11 as a bit. And that's pretty good. I'm into that. And I don't think that we should take the genre too seriously. I think it's mostly really dumb. That's my position. Send emails about that to Kyle. That upsets you.
Yeah. Biden at whitehouse.gov is my email address.
That's true.
I promise to forward it to the real authorities.
Yeah, that's right. The government of Israel, folks.
Speaking of government, did you see the D-Linka formally dissolved today?
I did not see that. What happened?
I mean, it was in that. So there's a split. There's been like Germany's going to have a really crazy couple of parliamentary years. Elections are going to be in general really weird over the next year, and I'm looking forward to seeing the madness. But so mm-hmm. there's one of the I can't remember the lady's fucking name.
Sarah Wagenknecht.
She's a pretty well-known figure in the German Left Party, which formed in I think like 2005. And she's been talking about a potential split because Die Linke has been doing very poorly. They almost lost like all of their seats in parliament in the last election. And with the rise of like new alternative quote unquote populist parties, there's been elements of Die Linke that have gotten very, they fashion themselves as populists who are, you know, messaging to the majority. If you can guess that they are pro increased border security and anti pronoun, then you would be correct. fucking shocker. So they formally announced a split in the intent to form a new party in January a couple of weeks ago. And I guess today it basically like it was a death knell for Die Linke. I mean, like Die Linke was probably going to dissolve, and I guess they just formally did so today. So the EU elections in, was it fucking June or something like that of 2024, of which this new party, whatever they call it, is
Für Vernunft und Gerechtigkeit.
They're allowed to stand for elections for the EU government. And if they manage to do well, which they're polling kind of well, then they'll be able to stand for the next parliamentary elections as a party. And so that's going to be really interesting. Germany is going to, I mean, they already, you know, they have three party coalition representing the government for the first time in however many years. And now it's going to start to like everyone, like all, like there's like six parties that are polling well enough to enter parliament. It's going to be really funny, and weird, and probably bad, because this also is a big part of 1 in 5 voters say they'll vote for AfD, who are in fact the baddies.
Yeah, this comes off the back as well of Germany posturing about how they're going to remilitarize more, just earlier today or yesterday. I think we should go to war with Germany just preemptively. Like, we're not doing this one again. Absolutely not. Let's fucking bomb the shit out of Germany. We're not. No. It can't be Trollboy. We're not doing it.
Yeah. It's going to be a weird year next year. I hope everyone is ready. The elections in the United States are going to be weird.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be 99% Hitler versus 100% Hitler. I heard on Twitter.
In the best case scenario for Democrats, the Senate is going to be a tie, so they have to win the presidential election. But the guy who just dropped out of the Senate is talking about running as a centrist, which means that it could take a lot of votes away from Joe Biden. And then there's Robert Kennedy Jr., who is running, who apparently is taking votes away from Trump. He was running as a Democrat, but now he's running as an independent. So he's in the wackiest scenario so far. There could be at least four relatively well-known candidates for the American presidency next year. And so I'm looking forward to that as well. More video game news.
Yeah, I mean, American Democracy is one of the worst video games of all time, so I think it's right for us to, you know, to review it. It's historic, really. It's like, you know, if you do film stuff, you got to talk about The Room at least once, right? You know. I feel that here in the UK, the video game situation is comparatively stable. Every party is aligned in that they love genocide and expanding the rights of like property owners, and that's kind of, there's not really anything else on the table.
Yeah, landlords.
Yeah, we need more landlords if possible. we've looked at like the declining home ownership rates and like the rents compared to like wages trajectory that we've seen over the last like 20 ish years, and let's make more of that. We think those are cool, and the country will be in a good place going forward. There is, I think this is true in a lot of countries, but it feels very stark in the UK at least, where like there is this caste of landowners who are like fucking 60 plus who have the most right-wing politics on the planet, just holding their children prisoner. And it's just kind of an insane situation to be in. And also it is, this is not a new observation. I feel like this was a big sort of conversation that happened during the 2020 election, I think. That's when like the whole OK Boomer meme happened, maybe. Mm-hmm. God, that feels like a lifetime ago. Yeah. But like, yeah, young people fucking hate old people. Which I don't think that's going to have good implications going forward.
It's concerning, maybe.
I feel like I would not be shocked if I saw in my lifetime people calling for, I'm not sure which work of sci-fi did this premise first, but pick your favorite half of the episodes of Star Trek, probably. You know, forming a society in which everyone just goes into like the death box at like 50 years old or something.
Yeah, Logan's Run.
Logan's Run. Logan's Run.
I fucking love Logan's Run, by the way.
Yeah, Logan's Run fucking rules. Not as a blueprint for society, but exactly. Like, I feel like if you ran on that in like 20 years, when like people who grew up as millennials are getting on in age, they'd be like, yeah, I'm sick of being alive anyway, and I saw what happened with my grandparents. Let's go in the box. So
new techno eugenics.
Yeah.
It'll be Amazon will make it, and it will, like, I don't know, you can play Pokemon Go on it while it kills you.
Absolutely. I mean, I read, so this is tangentially related. I recently read, forget his first name, Hardin's The Tragedy of the Commons.
Mm.
Which I feel like I spent a lot of my younger years online being told by anti-communists, like, oh, you got to read Tragedy of the Commons. That proves why communism doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And given the general level of understanding of these people, I was never inclined to take their suggestion. But I read it the other day. And first of all, dog shit, obviously. But also, something that I didn't actually realize is that the whole thing is an argument for regulating who can reproduce. I don't know if you've actually subjected yourself to it or not.
No, I'm familiar with the text and the larger metaphor.
Sure.
That's kind of stemmed from it. It's tangentially related, but it's kind of related to the game that we're talking about today, which is just libertarianism. Yeah. Like, it's all a form of like early 20th century libertarianism. Which I still to this day find really interesting. I'm still kind of obsessed with it. That's why I've watched so much Yellowstone. But I can talk about Yellowstone later when we talk about the game.
Oh, I have not seen Yellowstone. So I'm interested.
It's just Batman for boomers. It's Batman for boomers.
I thought Batman was Batman for boomers.
Yeah, I know. Batman is Batman for boomers, but I guess I mean more like the post 1980s Batman.
I see.
It's the contemporary Batman for boomers.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to pretend that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. If anyone says otherwise, I'm going to ban them from the comment section or come to their house with a hammer, whichever. I guess the point I was getting to with Tragedy of the Commons is that it actually doesn't really say anything about communism. It proposes, actually, communism solves the problem it presents. I'm sure that Hardin probably didn't realize that. But the big hypothetical is that a pasture held in common, that's how talking works, would lead to problems because individual cattle owners would choose to personally profit from increasing their own amount of cattle to the detriment of the grazing land. So that's a situation that implies common access to land but private property, and that's the big thing that he's worried about, which it's personally funny to me that there was probably a good decade there where this text was being deployed in like half-assed arguments against my politics.
Interesting. It's kind of Randian when you think about it, and like it's also really interesting that the essay came out in 1968, which is,
I mean, that was the time for it to come out, because the big, like, I would dispute that this is when it really starts, but the environmental movement really explodes in like the 60s and 70s, and this is people start thinking about global food production and things like that in this way that really, you know, Malthus kind of makes a big comeback here, and dude opens the fucking essay by uncritically being like, well, Malthus said this would happen, so I'm going to take that as fact and move on, which is,
yeah, again, that's cool. Eugenics.
Yeah.
let's be weird. Yeah. Being weird about the population is my first red flag for when anyone does anything.
Yeah. Especially from a biologist. This guy was a biologist. I don't need to hear that from him.
I could see that kind of as like an epistemology problem, or maybe like a standpoint issue from the perspective of like a a biologist attempting to venture into social issues, funny yeah. enough, in a year where like social issues including control of the commons were being contested all over the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, academics, man, are
mostly dumb as shit, actually, it seems.
But I think that's really interesting. And like it's not weird for that kind of thought process to kind of veer into weird like libertarian projects, like, you know, the imagination of a libertarian eugenics project that chooses who incorporates into their sort of like micro commune that's on its own whatever independent currency or whatever.
Yeah,
also no age of consent.
Oh, no age of consent, obviously. Well, no, that, age of consent, you know. Except, well, that only applies to white children, because no one else is allowed to fuck. That's because he ultimately Tragedy of the Commons is an argument for state regulated breeding, and it's pretty clear who he thinks should and shouldn't be. So it's also a great kind of early example of this type of libertarian obviously being just foaming at the mouth waiting to become a fascist, you know. He just needs a little something. He's right there, and that's exciting for him. That does tie, I think, quite well into the game that we're going to talk about this week, unless there's anything else you wanted to go over.
No, I think we can veer into the Batman.
That's right, folks. We're doing, you know, actually... I've been consistently forgetting to introduce the podcast for so many episodes in a row. It's very funny. I guess it doesn't feel that people know what they're listening to, but it feels weird. Just go into it.
We got all the way through the German EU elections in 2024 before we managed to even introduce it, which is pretty funny to me.
Yeah, actually, the past like 20 to 30 minutes, that was all cold open. You're listening to AGAB. What's up? It's Kay. It's Kyle. You know what it is. We're going to talk about a game that is very thoughtful about mental illness, about crime and incarceration as part of our, I was going to say our relatively thoughtful series on prison that we've been doing, but I did remember we did A Way Out, which was very dumb. So this isn't actually going to be that much of an outlier. We're doing Batman Arkham Asylum.
Take it away, boys. Take me on home to the asylum. Never alone in the asylum. Anarchy ruled. It was wild, but through it all you never smiled. Joke's on you. I'm in your head, so look who's laughing.
So Kyle, Batman, he's back. You've heard of him. You know his work. And it turns out that there's people who just, they've got bad brains. And so they need to be locked in like a cage. It's a prison, really, except they get like medication, and as we discover, perhaps there's some human experimenting going on. What do you think? This seems like a good system, right?
I mean, if I know anything, there's, you know, has anyone thought of this? The relationship between asylums and clinics and prisons? Is that like a...
Nope, actually, I'm writing that down right now. I think that's a fresh one.
That argument, I'm going to veer away from that because it's the most fish in a barrel. So yeah, Arkham Asylum is, as a game, it's interesting to me. I think the first thing that struck me about like watching... I watched a playthrough of someone else playing it, having played it in college, and remembering almost nothing about the story. And then upon watching it again, realized that the story is a lot sparser than I remembered it being. And it's much more about, you know, shifting around in air vents and looking for little trinkets and watching, listening to sort of voice memos that occasionally give you context for the sort of larger, you know, Arkham Island lore or whatever, but that usually just kind of like, they're more like Easter eggs, I feel. So that was interesting.
That was the era for just everything is audio logs as well.
Yeah, the trinkets and doodads audio log BioShock thing.
Yeah.
One thing that jumped out to me is that I didn't realize it at the time for some reason, but the relationship between the game and between Batman the Animated Series, which is one of the only Batman things that I've seen a decent amount of, because I was a child when it was on, and I mm-hmm. watched television as a child. But like, the central voice cast is all the same. The guy who wrote the story for it is the creator of Batman the Animated Series. I think that's part of the reason why, upon also rewatching it, actually, no, we've been talking about games that have really good voice acting recently. This is not necessarily one of them. it's very good. I thought it was great, but that's because I thought it was hilarious. It's very silly. I was going to say that there's a disparity between the more ancillary voice actors in the central cast, but sometimes there's not. The Kevin Conroy's Batman is very funny to me. He's wooden and like completely matter of fact. Everything is delivered in the exact same level, like, you know,
I love
like
a it.
4 out of 10. It's like Batman on Xanax. And it's really funny to me.
I've always been a huge fan of Kevin Conroy's Batman, because it makes Batman feel like more like a performance, because he's so inhuman. You know, he is just everything. He's always, like you say, exactly at 4 out of 10.
It's this bridge to the earlier material. Like, it's dark, but like at the same time, it's kind of goofy a little bit. I like that. I think that's funny. Yeah.
I think, and so we see this in the animated series a lot. The 90s one, where of course it's Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill. The goofier the situation you put him in, the funnier it is, because he does not rise to the goofiness. He stays at 4 out of 10 aggressively. And it starts to make it feel like it's a coping mechanism for Bruce Wayne, you know, which I enjoy that. What did you think of Mark? What did you think of Mr. Skywalker on the Jokertron? I feel like he's generally a fan favorite.
Yeah, and I like, honestly, I think it's for good. It's just, honestly, it's just for good reason.
Yeah, he's kind of the king around here.
It's a voice acting performance that, like, you can tell the difference between, like, we live in the kind of the age of the celebrity, you know, Chris Pratt is the voice of everything. I saw something again today where someone was just like, I didn't think Chris Pratt was a good choice for the voice, but I'm like, wait, he's in another thing?
Oh, was he Garfield?
Yes, that was it. He's Garfield.
That's
why.
What does this guy have on fucking producers in Hollywood? What is going on?
it was just a really weird choice, and we made fun of the Mario choice like everyone else did. That was goofy one.
Yeah, of course.
The thing about Mark Hamill is that he's a really, really good voice actor.
Yeah, he's
and
incredible.
The Joker, he puts a lot in the Joker character, and I think he really, like, it worked in a video game in a way that, like, it shows that, like, because the, you know, the Batman voice felt kind of even sillier and a little more uncanny in the context of like a video game, because the dialogue is different. There's like a lot of gaps, and then all of a sudden there's this like weird guy mumbling to himself, and I love it. it's not as organic, but that's a reason why I think all of the Joker scenes had a little more of a cinematic quality. I mean, he's always talking to you from somewhere else, so it helps. He's these big long monologues, but he does something with it, like, he's just skilled enough, I guess, to just kind of bring a scene to life, so you just kind of sit there and watch, and it's very honestly, there's a reason why he's so well loved. It's very impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. My view has always been that he largely carries this game. I think definitely You were right before that a lot of the more peripheral characters, in fairness to them, you know, Conroy and Mark Hamill have been doing these characters at that point for...
Yep.
I don't remember when this game... Probably like 20 years they've been doing these characters.
At least 15 years. This game was like 2009, I think.
Yeah, okay. So like... They've really gotten comfortable in the role. A lot of these other people would have just been hired and been like, okay, you're Scarecrow now. So go figure that out. So, you know, it's fair enough that they might not be quite as good. But in a way, it's almost kind of appropriate how hammy a lot of the other voice acting is as well. Like,
yeah,
there's something very kind of B-horror about this game to me. Like the premise... Okay, you are a detective and you're trapped in an asylum, basically, and everyone's crazy and you gotta get out alive. You know, if you did it less hammy, it would be embarrassing because it's so fucking silly, you know.
Like, it can't be so far up its own butt because it is, like, neo-noir. But that's the thing about neo-noir is that it, like, often turns out to be... Well, I mean, you know, well, Batman was always perfect for it because neo-noir is... about this kind of libertarian fantasy. Libertarian, not like as much as we were talking about just a bit ago, which is in influence. The thing about libertarianism is that it's so disjointed that it has 8 million different meanings and there's 8 million different types of them. But not like the, you know, influenced by the 18th century economics guys that we were talking about before, but more the like mid 20th century Americans that like, it's all about this kind of recuperating this fantasy, like some kind of, you know, both individuated and vigilante fantasy world that, like, if you're anywhere, like, if it does end up taking itself seriously, which, like, Frank Miller's Batman really clearly does in a lot of ways, it can be, like, when you become a passive observer to it, it can be, I don't know, it's just funny to me. And so neo-noir, just like in the sort of like neo-Western space, which also has shares similar sort of like political ideas, I've always found it really interesting, mostly because I find it kind of absurd and silly in places. The Batman as a character becomes this like, I don't know, something that I don't feel the need to take seriously. And I thought the Asylum, I haven't read the original source material. I know it's like a composite piece, but that it's largely inspired by one story that was, it basically follows the same thing, that Joker has taken over the Arkham Asylum because a bunch of his goons are all in there after one of the other prisons like was overflowing or something like that. So they stuck him in the asylum on Arkham Island. Joker takes it over and Batman has to do something about it.
Arkham Asylum, a serious house on serious earth.
Yes, that exactly. Grant Morrison.
Yeah. No, we don't respect the source material enough to do that kind of homework. So we have not read that. So I shan't be pulling from that. But I am glad that you brought up the libertarian sort of tendencies in Batman in general, definitely. I should say in the people who write Batman. I am at great pains to stress to the audience that Batman is not real. No matter what they tell you on YouTube.com. There's something I've been thinking about when thinking about this game, which is, and we talked about this a bit before the pod, we talked a bit about the general distaste for mental health institutions, but not from like a disability activism angle at all. But more from a, like, this is where, like, soft liberals are letting criminals get off easy. We see that in Miller's... What did he rename it again? I've already forgotten.
Arkham Home for the Emotionally Troubled.
Yeah. Miller, maybe more than anyone, but I think it's nowhere near unique to him, is very... He's just annoyed with the idea that someone who commits crimes ought to be treated in a mental health facility rather than a prison. I think that we see the general treatment of Arkham Asylum as incompetent. It's narratively necessary. Arkham Asylum can't be good at its job because that's where the villains go and have to break out of every other fucking week so we can have a new thing. But as a result, you've got this very ineffective system that Batman is ultimately fighting to restore. And it kind of got me thinking that this is sort of the libertarian version of what a lot of popular media that nods at, like, socialist ideas does. Uh-huh. And I've certainly complained about this on YouTube.gov. But they'll have someone who is like, you know, I agree with this, like, nominally left-wing position, but I've got to restore the status quo. And this kind of feels like that for a libertarian. He's like, this medical institution is not working. Not letting criminals take full responsibility for their crime sort of thing. Like, this is all a problem. The only thing that can solve it is the strong vigilante individual who we can all project ourselves on and feel like big buff boys. But he is, in the end, going to restore Arkham Asylum. And I just wonder if that feels the same for them, or, you know, if they are capable of thinking. I wonder that also. But I think that's kind of funny. I think it's funny that the draw towards kind of liberal status quo is even present in a lot of art that kind of has a right-wing bent to it.
Yeah, and it's through, I think, like, I was talking about Yellowstone earlier as this kind of, dude, this kind of paratextual thing, which I think the main divide between the two, besides just distance, because Yellowstone is more contemporary, the main difference is in their rural and urban settings. Mm-hmm. As a result, there's this, like, it takes on this more, like, localized ideological bent in Yellowstone, which Yellowstone is just about, it is about an historic ranch in Montana that one family has owned since literally the prequel shows that they're making about it in the late 19th century, basically depicting the sort of land grab in the 19th and the 20th century from this, yes, in more occasionally morally ambiguous position. But mm-hmm. the case of Yellowstone, like, the prequels are, like weird, like, melodrama fiction, just like Yellowstone is, but they're produced in a different, like, they're sort of a different story in some instances. But the show is, that show, the most popular and original show, is set in the present day, and it's about basically a rancher who is trying to prevent all kinds of people, including competing developers, mostly from California, which is something that's happening. There's an influx of people who are moving and buying short-term rentals in Montana and, like, fucking up local economies for people considerably. But this story is about a guy who owns basically the size of a national park, and is defending it from the government, environmentalists, from everybody, by virtue of this sort of, like, individual, a virtue tied to, like, family heritage, and as well as that's also mixed up in some, like, he speaks a lot from, you know, cattle ranching as a particular need and not as a profit generating mechanism. It sort of cuts out of your typical economic conversation, like in the Randian sense, how Atlas Shrugged is about literally industrialists.
Yeah.
Again, set in a different time period. Yellowstone is about placing into question some elements of contemporary society that they didn't used to do in the middle of the 20th century. But it's still, like, the Randian philosophy is very atheistic. It's very cynical about a lot of different institutions. And, like those other sort of, like, you know, libertarian junk philosophies, it's the perfect place for the literary characteristics of libertarianism to kind of flourish,
right?
Because superheroes are, Batman is the perfect libertarian character. It makes perfect logical sense. He's a, like, in, you just take this sort of, like, defense of individual, like, enlightened individual who just wants to be left alone, sort of begrudgingly agrees to defend the very institutions that they themselves critique, and it. It's this, like, it's so not just, like, sometimes very pea-brained, like, it is so cynical and, like, just as you were saying, like, incapable of addressing some of the most basic and important significant social problems that should have already been addressed by now, but instead were mixed up in this sort of, like, ideological soup that's like, again, it's very Randian. It's from this position that, like, you know, selfishness is a virtue, because she called altruism the arrested moral development of mankind. That's a quote.
Yeah.
Like correlating selfishness with evil is itself the ultimate evil. So you have to come to an ethical self-realization. These anti-heroes are perfect characters for that, because Batman, despite not wanting to do some of the things that he does, comes to this ethical self-determined realization that it's necessary. And so instead of looking to institutions that we could build to be good and do good things, we instead look to enlightened vigilantes, sort of like that's who we're supposed to seek answers from. They're not perfect. They make bad choices. They make hard choices, unlike all the rest of us or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, so you see why it's so easy that, like, these games, like, what Gotham wants truly is a very powerful Night Watchman state. Like, it's a libertarian ideal fantasy. Like, it's cops in judicial systems, and it exists only to defend, like, people from murder and defend private property rights.
As we're talking about this, I'm realizing how prevalent this is as a trend, right? Of the libertarian rugged individual who is kind of begrudgingly defending ultimately the thing that they're supposedly critiquing or against. And I think a big part of that is, you might not agree with this. This is I think that on some level, many libertarians, in fact, know that the economic aspect of their politics is literally impossible. And this renders them into much more conventional conservatives, but who want to have, they want to be someone who believes in these specifically libertarian tenets. And I think that they use it to then color a much more, to color a politics that is not, for example, actually antagonistic in any way to the state or state institutions, despite supposedly, you know, government being what's hindering sort of great innovators from, you know, putting humanity on the moon or whatever thing they think is important right now. I think that practically speaking, that is never really part of what they focus on, other than in some more minor selfish ways, like, you know, I don't want to pay taxes. So I think it's interesting that consistently the stories that are being told about these sorts of people are stories in which they do on some level see that, like, yeah, this more kind of liberal state institution has to be in some way upheld.
They're like, well, I mean, I generally agree, and particularly for there, I believe that there's this kind of choice that a lot of libertarians make, that on the one hand is the kind of sort of walk more of a familiar party line, and then on the other hand spin off into weird sort of, like, at least all of this is in the US, by the way. I'm trying not to be a chauvinist about that as much recently, assuming that everyone knows I'm always talking about the United States, or spinning off into this weird kind of, like, sovereign citizenship, like, you can't pull me over because I'm not a citizen of the United States and I'm allowed to drink and drive, kind of really cool stuff like we have in New Hampshire.
Yeah, that's true about me. I'm not a citizen of the United States, so I can drink and drive. But carry on.
Yeah. I speak all of them. The problem that I think you're kind of pointing to is that there are generally examples of the more extreme side of this laissez-faire libertarian ideology that have been put into practice in government, at least in the United States, and it was always a disaster. I don't want to misremember too many details about the first story, but I said New Hampshire, and I've forgotten. At one point, there was a small town, I guess, in New Hampshire that got taken over by weirdo libertarians who cut all of the city's budget and cut a whole bunch of services and stuff, including, I believe, the trash services. And what happened is the town got taken over by bears, because it's fucking New Hampshire and there are bears everywhere. And so there's a whole story about it on, like, The Cut or something like that. I'll try and track it down, that you can read about online. I think someone ended up writing a book about it. And the second story is, like, and this is the more serious, like, there is a small, like, state size like laissez-faire libertarian project that happened for the better part of 8 years in Kansas under the governorship of Sam Brownback, who was a senator and then elected governor. And he made all of the cuts that all the libertarians who were the more acceptable party line libertarians talk about that they want to make, did all of the stuff in the quote unquote responsible, you know, cuts, no matter what, lower your taxes, guys always say they're going to do. And what fucking happened? Like he tanked his state's economy and like ruined the budget, like, because none of it ended up making any fucking sense.
Yeah.
Like, and then Kansas, like, now there is a history of U.S. states that are more red in federal elections electing Democratic governors and vice versa, but they elected a Democrat as their governor, like, right after that, because he was so fucking terrible. So, you know, there are clear examples of their economic policies and plans that have been put into practice on big and small scales, and they've all been pretty shitty for the vast majority of everybody. So, you know, it almost like the retreat into the fantasy is necessary by, like, you know, virtue of their inability to do things good.
Yeah, I feel like occupying reality is one of the big things that separates a libertarian from a neoliberal. Because a neoliberal is going to be ideologically bent towards privatization, things being run as businesses, and downplaying, you know, the role of the state. But they know, even if they don't say it, they know that the state is necessary for all of those things to function. Like a lot of people, like Thatcher, one of, you know, the considered to be one of the first in the big neoliberal turn, I guess, was massive on industrial subsidies and saw a huge role for the state while rhetorically sounding a lot like a libertarian. The point is that she knows which parts are a lie, basically. And it's very exciting when someone who's a real true believer and like, no, if we just remove entire like state industries and institutions and services from my state or my town or whatever, that'll do something. Something will happen there, and that something is bears. That's exciting.
That something is indeed bears. Or a bunch of shirtless weirdos take over your asylum.
Yeah, I mean, the mentally ill are really the bears of Gotham City. I think that's fair to say.
The New Republic. And the article is called The Town That Went Feral.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think it's a... I think that's a book... The book review of the book. Which is that a fun? Yeah, the book. It's a book titled "A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear," the utopian plot to liberate an American town (parentheses) and some bears, which is honestly a pretty funny title. I'll give him that.
Yeah, it's really good. So having talked about libertarianism, I feel like that is a perfect segue into something I wanted to talk about in relation to this game, of course, which is mental illness. Sick burn. There's this tension in a lot of media, but I think Batman might be one of the most egregious, I guess, in trying to think about mental illness, sometimes in an empathetic way. And I'm thinking about The Long Halloween is a good example. The Killing Joke is the one I'm thinking of. Mm. Is a good example of how clumsily this is sometimes done. But a thing that I like about Batman, I'm not saying they do it well almost ever, but I like that the fact that he is clearly a deeply traumatized and unwell man invites this introspection. Like, that's an interesting thing about the characters, is there's very little that separates him from, you know, the Joker or something, realistically, other than, you know, having his strong individual moral compass, which therefore means we can trust him to dispense justice and the law and whatever he wants. We could trust them with our kids. They'll take them to an island. So this game, I think, is a great example of that weird tension, because there are some characters where it seems like it's trying to build a type of empathy for the fact that they aren't well. But in general, the inmates of the asylum are like, they're monsters. They come like popping out of fucking floorboards and shit when you're walking down hallways. They just mob you like mindless fucking animals. Like, they're not really human beings in like 90% of the game, which is really reflective of how superhero stuff treats, you know, people who are quote unquote crazy in general. It's, you know, especially a lot of Batman's antagonists. And I just find it fascinating that at least these days, and by these days, I mean in the 21st century overall, they never feel like they can fully just not think about mental illness at all. Like, there's always a bit of like, there's always a bit of consideration, even in Arkham Asylum, which is often communicated through Batman, while trying to have their cake and eat it too, and be like, no, these people are insane. They're basically, you know, they're basically bears. I find that tension fascinating.
I hadn't thought about the relationship between, it's kind of like, politics, like Batman sort of general politics of criminality with its ideas around madness and insanity, which like it almost serves that, like, again, it's almost like, you know, it's like fish in a barrel. It's almost too easy, but it settles in this really interesting kind of conversation of, like, that happens in, especially in sort of Batman properties, this idea that, like, there's this uncontrollable enemy and it's all about concealment, mm-hmm. and like the dark core, like everything is a seedy underbelly that's ready to be like unveiled, which is noir. Like that's what noir is like the sort of literal. In the sequel to this game, Arkham City, is that what it was called?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like everything kind of feels like it's a really like good looking game in a lot of ways, and I think it's not for and not to be annoying about it, but not, I don't think necessarily for the reason that people would say it is. But it part of like what makes that game look right is how homogenized it kind of feels because of this chiaroscuro kind of like, and I use that relatively lightly, but that's appropriate for noir. Like, there's this, you know, tension between light and dark that penetrates all the way sort of to the center of the story. I mean, and it's so on the nose that the most isolated and like sort of controlled elements of society, the criminally insane, are on their own island in their own wing of a larger building, building, and that how that whole sort of all of those structural elements appear to be tied throughout the, you know, I mean, I know that it's a comic book, it's supposed to be easy to understand, but like, and be like, yeah, Gotham, like spooky New York, but
Goth New York.
I don't know. Yeah, I just hadn't thought about its relationship, like, yeah, and you're exactly right. The characterizations of like the unknowability and like perpetual fear of these categories of people. The idea is that like society, like, and this is the only Foucauldian point I'll make or whatever. Society develops a point of view over time, and that's what these sort of like epistemology of madness is about. Is that like, we learned in the 18th century to classify and like, but to classify and organize the way that we think about people in the same way that we think about, like, the Foucauldian argument is that we do botanical classification to hierarchize things. And I think in general, that's pretty true in like the attempt to sort of like, demonstrate and diagnose society's point of view when it comes to madness, which is criminally most of the time.
Yeah.
So we have all of these sort of like principles of analogy and the organization of people and systems all of a sudden. And so, like, all of a sudden we're connecting these very much more contemporary or modern than we realize ideas around how people are, and we are naturalizing them in a way that I don't think is good, personally. Yeah, I don't know. This demonstrates that more effectively than I remembered it doing. And that's funny. I was playing this in college, and I was reading Foucault when I was playing this. I actually remember that, which is funny to me.
That's kind of a sick way to experience it, actually.
He was assigned in my theory class, and I was playing that the year I was playing this game.
I mean, yeah, like you said, kind of off the top, it's shooting fish in a barrel, but obviously, yeah, rediscipline and punish while playing Arkham Asylum. That's pretty, that's a straightforward 1-2 punch. I feel like it almost helps the process of naturalizing the way we sort of characterize this type of I guess, insanity by the way that Batman himself is treated. Like, you see it in a lot of Batman stuff. You see it, I think, Mask of the Phantasm is a really good example, one of the 90s animated series movies. This game, during the Scarecrow segment, especially, or segments, I think, it really highlights Batman as, like, a traumatized, unwell man. And in a way, it's almost, he's almost a Bootstraps story. Like, this is an insane man who is not criminal. Therefore, the inherent kind of, like, degenerate nature of all of these other people in the asylum is almost exacerbated by that. Because it suggests almost a greater moral failing, because, you know, what's their excuse? Batman, he's a brain freak.
More conservative media does this, like, all the time with, yeah, like, they use, like, veteran status and, like, shell shock or PTSD to, like, or they use these sort of, like, elements of experience to, like, reclassify a cop in a way that is, like, you know, gives them sort of leeway to do more morally gray things, while also the, like, you know, the opportunity to have gained that particular moral clarity so they can intervene and be a good, virtuous person. Ooh, that's interesting. I like that.
Yeah, and this is very much in that tradition, which I always found really interesting, and why I don't know if I can say that's the reason, or if this treatment of Batman grew out of this. That's for people who think about comic books more than I do, and more than maybe they should. But it's interesting how much of his rogues gallery is just, like, insane people, basically, considering that's kind of what the ideas that they're playing with. And I think it also, I was about to say he has an interestingly unpolitical rogues gallery, but there's, you know, there's exceptions. Poison Ivy is one, obviously. But I feel like that's maybe a bit more of a Marvel thing, even before the fucking MCU, to have enemies be like, I have a big ideological thing I want to do. Whereas Batman's villains, it's a lot of it is just like mob bosses, but with brain damage, so they have like a quirky thing they do.
Yeah, I dress up like this.
Half of my face is burned, and that makes me kill people for some reason. Nobody knows.
I can't do anything without flipping a coin. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's a type of guy we all knew in high school. Don't worry about that. Are there any other aspects of this game you wanna explore, delve into?
I guess, yeah. Like, it's an interesting revisit from the sort of, like, atmospheric point, or all, if you're interested in the sort of, like, literary arc of the character leading up into it's sort of like what a lot of people see, you know, I have no skin in the game, so I have no idea. I have no stance. What people see as a sort of new arc in the Batman with the Nolan movies, which also at the same time is like, oh man, the only thing that we didn't get into and we won't need to is it's the relation, the sort of spiritual relationship between Frank Miller's influence on the character and then put next to other Frank Miller properties like fucking 300, which I think is absolutely in conversation with it is in sort of like political dialogue with properties even like this one, but especially the other Miller heavy properties that came out around this time period. The gameplay for these games for me is a little repetitive, so if you're interested in this type of a thing but don't feel like playing it, you should watch it on YouTube like I did.
Yeah, I also had played it when I was a bit younger, so I sort of reviewed it watching someone else play. When I first played it, the gameplay was okay, but I feel like it might not have aged very well considering I think subsequent games improve upon it a lot. I think the Insomniac Spider-Man game actually improves on a lot of ingredients from this game, and going back to it might be kind of tough now, but I think I kind of liked it for the vibes. I don't know. If you're not scared off by sort of like mediocre combat and a bit of tedious looking around for stuff, I might recommend playing it just because I think it's a vibes-based game. I think it's a good atmospheric sort of horror setting almost, but with utterly bizarre political choices. It's kind of fun to walk through.
Yeah, and really weird good bad voice acting. This weird mix of like campy comical characters with Mark Hamill.
Yeah, you know, you get told you're going to be in a Batman game, so you go for, you know, you go for this campy kind of cartoony thing. Like, I get why you would do it, and then it comes out a little awkward because the game's actually kind of going for this very like 2000 sort of gritty thing in a lot of ways, but it's
super too fun. Silly. Yeah, but when people say that it's really really good, they mean Mark Hamill. And all the rest of it is very good for different reasons. So
yeah, Mark Hamill's enjoyed great. It. Yeah,
I enjoyed it quite a bit.
And you know, if you grew up watching the '90s Batman cartoon, you'll probably enjoy a lot of it as well. It's got a lot of that DNA. Also, you know, I won't spend too much time on it because we're nearly at the end of the episode. But 300, that is another great example of disabled people are evil media. So. Cool, Frank Miller, you little fuck.
Yeah, weird take. Weird take.
Except instead of an ethnic other in Arkham Asylum, it's just all disabled people. So that's better? No, I guess. All right, actually, we should talk about the Nolan movies behind the paywall.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Let's fucking do that. We need further Batman discussion, and I'm currently working on an Oppenheimer video where I might say a couple of I'm not going to commit, but I might say a couple of complimentary things to Christopher Nolan. So I need to restore balance to the universe and not absolve give people the yourself. Wrong idea. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I don't know if this is going to be the last one forever, but I think there's a few games we've been wanting to talk about that aren't really prison related, so this might be a good point to at least temporarily conclude the prison series.
Yeah, call it a chapter in a larger audio collection of very important examinations.
Absolutely.
From the gamers.
Yeah. Because I know we've there's other games on the list, like prison relevant games that we've been thinking about, and at some point we'll definitely get to those. But like, a new Armored Core came out, buddy. We got
it. Yeah, it's true, and it's really good.
Oh fuck, it's so good. All right. In that case, dear vile listener, I hope that you have enjoyed, especially the past few episodes where we've been talking about prison and trying to make sense of the way that. The fucked up art our culture produces makes sense of it. We're going to go behind the paywall. So where can the good people at home find you, Kyle?
You can find me up a tree. And interesting. Yeah.
Is it like a fruit-bearing tree? Are you nourished? Are you going to be okay?
I will come down eventually. You can also find me on YouTube at LaborKyle, where maybe there'll be something there, and maybe there won't be. But we'll have fun along the way. Okay, where do you... Where?
You can find me in a New Hampshire town breaking into your trash can because you didn't get one of those bear boxes. Idiot. More food for me. And you can find my bear-related YouTube videos at Kay and Skittles. You can find me on Twitter under the same name. I'm going to drop my link tree for all my shit, all my socials and my contents. And yeah, you know, you don't need to put lids on your trash cans when you take them out the night before garbage day. That's my just letting people know that. All right, bye.
I'm stuck in your head and I'm laughing. Ah, I feel you with dread and I can't stop laughing. Your parents are dead and I can't stop laughing. What else can I do? Now I'm part of you.